Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, part two of a fine talk by journalist Jeremy Scahill. It's a rousing condemnation of U.S. foreign policy, of the Obama White House, and of the prostitute news media, determined to serve their masters in Washington instead of questioning them. I hope you'll stay tuned. Jeremy Scahill continues with the story of American citizen Anwar al-Awlaki, killed in Yemen by order of President Obama, and Awlaki's son, American citizen Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, age 16, killed 2 weeks later by order of President Obama. But this is also the story of a courageous Yemeni journalist, Abdulela Haider Shaya. He discovered the truth about the secret U.S. bombing of his country and published it. He languished in a Yemeni prison at the specific request of President Obama for the crime of practicing journalism. And this is about the craven Washington Press Corps, who act like courtiers to the imperial presidency, not like journalists. Quite a contrast to Abdulela Haider Shaya. I've had to cut out a little bit of the talk to make it fit, so let's not dawdle here. Jeremy Scahill starts with a few words about Anwar al-Awlaki, and then goes on to Obama's new secret war in Yemen.
So Awlaki praises this act by Nidal Hassan, and that, for many Americans, I think was enough to say, Anwar al-Awlaki is a terrorist. That's really when the campaign started to say, you know, this guy is a terrorist and he's dangerous. That was the last blog he wrote. The CIA shut down his website, and al-Awlaki was forced to go underground. Meanwhile, back in Washington, a new president is in office, President Obama. And he comes in with no military experience, almost no foreign policy experience, and he is briefed by Admiral William McRaven, the commander of the Joint Special Operations Command, General Stanley McChrystal, who ran JSOC for the entire Bush era, and then was picked by Obama to lead the surge in Afghanistan, by General David Petraeus, one of the most powerful figures at the time in modern American military history, and the heads of all of these intelligence agencies, who paint a picture for Obama of a world where there are thousands of concurrent threats against the United States, plots to bring down airplanes, poison water supplies, attack American embassies. And they say to Obama, if you don't continue the authorizations that Bush gave us to strike outside of declared battlefields, and in fact, in some cases, if you don't expand them, then we're going to get hit. And Rahm Emanuel, your lovely mayor, and other political hacks within the administration are listening in on these briefings. And they're saying, they're envisioning what a one-term presidency looks like if there is an attack like that on U.S. soil. And so a political calculation was made that it's better to be aggressive and engage in a form of pre-crime or preemptive strikes against terrorist networks than to risk anything happening to the United States. And so Obama gives them authorities that they could only have dreamt about, JSOC and the CIA. So one of the first things that Obama does, in addition to surging in Afghanistan and authorizing an escalation of night raids, is to give JSOC permission to start bombing Yemen. And so on December 17th, 2009, about a month after the Nidal Hassan shooting incident happened, President Obama authorizes his first strike on Yemen. And they say that they're taking out a dangerous leader of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And he's in an area called al-Majla in Abyan province. And they authorized the strike with cruise missiles. They couldn't use drones because they were all, at the time, being used to bomb Pakistan. So they had to use cruise missiles launched from the sea. They hit the area in al-Majla. And the next day, the Yemeni government issues a press release saying that Yemen's Air Force had taken out an al-Qaeda training camp and killed 34 al-Qaeda terrorists. And the United States then sent a note of congratulations to the Yemeni government, praising them for their cooperation in the fight against al-Qaeda. And this story goes around the world. But then, a funny thing happened on the way to the victory dance. A brave young Yemeni journalist named Abdulela Haider Shaya traveled to that village with tribal leaders. And he took photographs of the missile parts. And he took photographs of the victims of the bombing being pulled from rubble. And what his photographic evidence showed, and what the testimony of eyewitnesses showed, was that far from being an Al-Qaeda training camp, this was a Bedouin village, and that among the dead were 14 women and 21 children. And the missile parts, when they ultimately were sent to Amnesty International by Abdullah Haider Shaya, and then reviewed by munitions experts, they were shown to be Tomahawk cruise missile parts and cluster bombs. Cluster bombs are basically like flying landmines. They just shred everything in their path. And most nations around the world have signed on to conventions banning cluster bombs, but the United States has refused because it continues to use them. So he reports this around the world, and his reporting was picked up by ABC News, NBC News, The Washington Post, the world over. It became clear that the United States was in fact bombing Yemen. And we knew that because of this one journalist who went to the scene, a place that the US and Yemeni governments never thought someone would go, and took pictures and interviewed survivors. A short time after he did that and went on TV talking about it, Abdullah Haider Shaya was arrested by Yemen's US-trained counterterrorism unit. And they took him to a political security prison in Yemen, and they beat him bloody. And they said, if you keep talking about the American missile strike, we're going to put you back in here for good. He did what I think any brave real journalist would do. He went out of that prison when they dumped him on the street, straight to Al Jazeera's studio, and said, the Yemeni regime is threatening me and telling me that if I don't stop talking about Al-Majla and the American bombing campaign, that they're going to put me back in prison. And he said, I'm going to continue reporting on this story. And he did. He continued reporting on that story. He continued reporting on that story until his house was raided in a night raid, and he was abducted and disappeared for 34 days. And then he was hauled into a political court that was set up by the Yemeni regime specifically to prosecute journalists for crimes against the dictatorship. And he was put in a cage in that courtroom. And we show this in our film. He was put in a cage in that courtroom and was charged with being an Al-Qaeda facilitator. And he was ultimately sentenced to 5 years in prison. Every major human rights organization and media freedom organization in the world condemned his trial. He refused to even present a defense. He had the best lawyers in Yemen come forward and say, we'll defend you. And he said, I don't want any of you to speak a word on my behalf in this court because I will not even recognize that it's a legitimate court. I will not put on a defense. And all he said was that my crime and the reason I'm here is for being a journalist. And he said, this is what they do to real journalists in Yemen. They use your reporting as evidence of a crime that you've committed, and they put you in prison for it. I have extensively reviewed his journalism over the years. His tough questioning of Al-Qaeda leaders puts to shame the clowns in the front row at the White House press corps. He had the audacity. He had the audacity to confront Al-Qaeda figures about their targeting of civilians to their faces and to present them with statements that they made and that contradicted verses of the Quran. Can you imagine what that would require for a Yemeni journalist to sit down with an Al-Qaeda figure and do a hardball interview with them? I mean, this fluff that happens with Chuck Todd and the gang, they're cowering in front of the Secretary of State, who doesn't have the ability necessarily to shave his beard maybe or whatever. No, but this guy could have been killed, and he's asking those questions, and these clowns are asking whether Beyonce was lip syncing at the inauguration, which I think she was, but that's beside the point. So he gets sentenced to 5 years in prison, and there is outrage in Yemen over this. And there are posters hung around the capital demanding his release from prison. And the dictator at the time, Ali Abdullah Saleh, is under huge pressure and decides, he's served enough time. I think he gets the message that he needs to shut up. I'm going to pardon him. Word leaks in the Yemeni media that he's going to issue this pardon. That day, the dictator of Yemen gets a phone call from the White House. Not from some undersecretary, not from a staffer, not from Joe Biden, from President Obama himself. And President Obama says to the Yemeni dictator that the United States is deeply concerned about reports that you're going to release Abdulela Haider Shaya. And that day, the pardon was torn up. And Abdulela Haider Shaya remains in prison to this day. He has been in prison for 3 years. 3 weeks ago, he smuggled a message out of the prison where he's in solitary confinement. I've spoken with people who have visited him, and they say he's losing his mind, as I think almost anyone would if you're in those conditions. But he smuggled a message out, and it said, "I understand that there are journalists in the United States and elsewhere that have taken up my cause, and I thank them. But I don't want people to say that the Americans are keeping me in prison. There's only one person keeping me in prison, and that's President Obama." And if you think about, well, hold on. If you think about where we are right now in this country and the war on journalists, there's a war on journalism around the world. And it's not just the US government. There are tyrants around the world that are targeting journalists, locking them up in prison. Record numbers of journalists have been killed around the world. And in this country, we have the idea of a democratic press under attack, but we also have a constitutional lawyer president who somehow thinks that it's right to intervene inside of Yemen and to have a journalist kept in prison whose real crime seems to be interviewing people that we're told are the enemies and exposing U.S. missile strikes in that country. Now, ABC News and the Washington Post and NBC News all were happy to run the journalism of Abdulela Haider Shaya when he was interviewing Anwar al-Awlaki because it was salacious and it grabbed headlines and they had their exclusive. But then when he's locked up in prison, not a single one of those outlets have said anything about his imprisonment. And when I asked someone from one of the, a very prominent journalist from one of those networks, why have none of you spoken out in his defense? He told me, well, the White House called all of us after you did that story, because I did a story about this when he was put in prison. And they said, don't buy into that. He's using the money you guys pay him to fund Al-Qaeda. Now, I know that American journalists are some of the cheapest bastards on earth when it comes to paying other journalists in other countries to work with them. If that's Al-Qaeda's fundraising strategy to get a couple hundred bucks from ABC News, then they are truly are decimated, if that, as you know, we're now told. But the point is, when there's a whiff of need to dissent from the official line, the powerful journalists in this country cower in a corner. It's the same way that they throw Glenn Greenwald under the bus and why Bradley Manning becomes some kind of a scared degenerate in a corner of a cell somewhere. They're afraid of their own shadows. They're afraid of their own shadows. They don't need anyone to tell them what to print and what not to print. They just do it for the government. And while on the issue of Bradley Manning for a moment, look at the way he was smeared. Look at the way he was smeared. They tried to make his sexual orientation and his choices in life that have nothing whatsoever to do with the stories that were broken because of his courage. They tried to make that the story front and center. He's a scared transgender, cowering in a corner. He's confused about his sexuality. All those stories being done about Bradley Manning, how he's suicidal. Then what happens? Then audio leaks out of his court-martial proceeding. And what do you hear when you hear Bradley Manning? You hear a calm, collected, principled young person who said, "I was not going to stand by and continue to participate in these actions, and I felt I needed to speak up." The next time someone who stands up gets smeared like that, remember what they told you was true about Bradley Manning, and then what you heard when he actually got to speak for himself, because it was two different worlds. One that was being painted by the government and its allies in the media, and the other just by the person himself. And when it comes down to who to believe, I believe Bradley Manning's portrayal of his own self and his own principles over anything that they write in the media. So you have President Obama authorizing bombing in Yemen. You have Anwar al-Awlaki now underground and realizing that the United States is bombing Yemen. And then in early 2010, you have President Obama actually authorizing the assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki, that he was placed on a kill list by the Joint Special Operations Command. And for 2 years, the Obama administration was hunting Anwar al-Awlaki, and they tried to, by my count, kill him upwards of a dozen times. And eventually, they did kill him on September 30th, 2011, but not before his family had tried to file suit just to demand that the government provide proof that Anwar al-Awlaki was an operational terrorist, that he was involved actively with terror plots against the United States. And instead of presenting that evidence in court, the Obama administration invoked the state secrets privilege. And they submitted affidavits from CIA Director Leon Panetta, Defense Secretary Robert Gates, Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, and all of them said, we have evidence against Anwar al-Awlaki, but if we were to present it in court, it would threaten the national security of the United States. So what they said is, we have the right to assassinate an American citizen without charging them with a crime, and we don't even need to show the other branch of government, another branch of government, any evidence to indicate that we're authorized to do this or that it is legal to do this. I mean, that's chilling when that declaration is made, because it's like an edict. It's some kind of an order of a monarch or something. I mean, it's incredible. It's supposed to be one of the things that separates dictatorships from democratic societies is the idea that people have a right to face their accusers, to know the evidence against them, and then to have a fair trial. And then they kill Anwar al-Awlaki, and they kill Samir Khan. And there were two basic reactions in Washington, silence and celebration. Hillary Clinton sounded just like John McCain in praising, you know, this great victory in the war against terrorism. Then it emerged that Samir Khan, this other American that was killed, wasn't actually a target. That's what they said in this strike. And a Republican congressman said, well, if he wasn't a target, he should have been. And he's called it a twofer, like it was a bonus kill. Since when did we believe that we can skip forward and just kill people who, even if they're engaged in plots, I mean, they're supposed to be due process. If we throw that out the door, then we should stop portraying ourselves as different than nations that have no trials, that just execute people based on the whims of a dictator or a king. We should say, well, we're actually more like Saudi Arabia than we are like Britain. Yeah. You know, I mean, stop portraying ourselves in a manner that says that we have anything to do with justice for all. We'll just have mob rule for some people. But 2 weeks after al-Awlaki was killed, his 16-year-old son, Abdulrahman al-Awlaki, who hadn't seen his father for 3 years, was sitting in an outdoor restaurant with his 17-year-old cousin Ahmed and some other youth from their tribe when a drone appeared above them and fired a missile and blew the teenagers up. They couldn't even find more than a part of Abdulrahman al-Awlaki's skull. And the reason that they knew it was him is because he had this huge head of hair that was sort of his rebellious trademark. He hadn't seen his father for 3 years, was being raised by his grandfather, was into hip-hop music and comic books, and was hanging out in the square, Change Square, protesting against the U.S.-backed dictatorship. Had nothing, was nothing like his father, and yet was killed in a drone strike. Why? The U.S. government has never explained why that kid was killed. At first, they tried to say he was 21 years old. Then the family produced the birth certificate showing that 2 months before he was killed, he had just turned 16, and that he was born in Denver, Colorado in 1995. Then they said, oh, well, he was with this al-Qaeda militant named Ibrahim al-Banna. Then it turns out that Ibrahim al-Banna is still alive. And in fact, he's still alive to this day. And then they said, well, he was at an al-Qaeda meeting. And then they brought forward the family members of the other people killed, and they said, well, you can investigate our lives. None of us are terrorists. So why was the kid killed? Well, when Robert Gibbs was asked about it, who, of course, is the former White House spokesperson, and then was the chief surrogate for the Obama re-election campaign, when Gibbs was asked about it, he said he should have had a more responsible father. There are a few things I can think of that are more shameful than blaming the killing of a child on who their parents are. And that was Robert Gibbs' statement. And in fact, I was on Rachel Maddow's show probably for the last time ever recently, and Gibbs was on right before me, and I wanted to be on with Gibbs because I was going to forget whatever we were talking about and go straight to asking Robert Gibbs that question. But he was on right before me, and now, you know, this is the thing, he's a paid commentator now, whatever you call him, on MSNBC. you know, it's, I mean, it really, it truly is like state media over there. Now you've got Robert Gibbs, David Axelrod. I mean, the whole crowd just hangs out at MSNBC, and then they'll go back into the White House and back out. So I was on right after him on Rachel's show, and I brought up Robert Gibbs. I said, well, you know, Robert Gibbs, who you just had on, said that the, you know, the kid should have had a more responsible father. I think that's shameful. And that Rachel was kind of like, ooh. Anyway, neither here nor there. So he says, Harry Reid, who the Senate Majority Leader, said if there were three American citizens who deserved to be killed, it was those three. Meaning Anwar al-Awlaki, Samir Khan, and then Abdulrahman al-Awlaki. He was directly asked about those three. I tried repeatedly to get his office to clarify what crime Abdulrahman al-Awlaki committed that you would say that he deserved to be killed. And his office would not respond to any of those inquiries. So you have a deafening silence on why this kid was killed. And then the White House releases, on the eve of Obama's big speech at the National Defense University, this letter from Attorney General Eric Holder. And in that letter, they say, yes, we've killed four American citizens in drone strikes. Anwar al-Awlaki, Samir Khan in Yemen, in the first one. Jude Muhammad, another American citizen, who actually had been indicted on terror charges, who was in Pakistan. And then Abdulrahman al-Awlaki. And they said only Anwar al-Awlaki was specifically targeted. And then they used this phrase that I'm sure was focus grouped at the CIA. They said the others were not specifically targeted. I've asked the White House to clarify, if I remove the word specifically from that sentence, is it still a true statement? They won't comment on that. They said the statement speaks for itself. Actually, the statement doesn't speak for itself. What does it mean, not specifically targeted? Anthony's not specifically speaking right now, but he did speak here, you know, earlier. So, it's Orwellian. It's like they redefined the term imminent in that earlier Justice Department white paper. Now they use the not specifically targeted. Well, I think it's possible that it was a signature strike, which to me is the most egregious aspect of the Obama drone program. Signature strikes are a form of bombing where the United States designates certain regions of certain countries as irreconcilable areas, and that anyone who is a military-aged male who is killed in those regions will posthumously be determined to have been a terrorist. And these are cases where the U.S. is, in fact, specifically targeting people whose specific identities it doesn't know. In other words, it's sort of like a grotesque form of pre-crime, like the movie Minority Report. Except in this case, there's no ball that pops up with any actual crime on it. It's just the idea that they must be up to something, so if we kill them, then we'll just say that they were terrorists. So we are targeting, the U.S. is targeting people whose identities are not specifically known and against whom they may have no evidence that they're involved with any crimes or terrorist plots. So is not specifically targeted a group of military-aged males sitting out in an outdoor cafe in a targeted region? We don't know. But the answer to why that kid was killed says a lot about who we are as a society and how far we've come. And the fact that the White House refuses to just clearly state why that kid was killed is in and of itself a story. And yet no one from that White House press corps will ask the president anything about this. The signature strike program is to me the best indicator of how out of control it's gotten under this Democratic president, to the point where they are engaged in a global pre-crime campaign, and that they have sold this to liberals as a smarter, cleaner way of waging war. I don't believe for a moment that if John McCain had won the election in 2008, that you would see the kind of rank intellectual dishonesty and hypocrisy that you see on a daily basis from so many liberals in this country. My question for them is, the next time a Republican is in office, are you going to then somehow be in favor of all these policies again? Do you want the big surveillance state? Do you believe in assassinating American citizens who haven't been charged with a crime? Are you going to find a way to run defense on the war against whistleblowers or the attacks against the press? Or this idea that the world actually is a battlefield and the United States has a right to deploy its military forces or drone strikes anywhere it pleases on any given day? Because if you don't believe in those things, but you only believe in them when your guy is in office, then it's not a principle. Then you've ceded your conscience to a politician or a political party. And you're not actually engaged in anything vaguely resembling an honest debate about American policy. You're just letting other people think for you. And don't think for a moment that those other people don't have massive corporate backing behind them that are pulling the levers in this machine. The number one thing any of us could be about if we actually want change in this society is to get corporations out of our political process completely. All of these policies, in one way or another, whether it's foreign policies or domestic policies, when we're looking at the situation with schools here in Chicago, when we're looking at gun violence in this country, when we're looking at the Keystone Pipeline, when we're looking at war policy, who benefits from any of this? It's corporations that benefit. Ordinary people, we don't benefit from it. The countries, I wouldn't call them ordinary people, the 1%. Yeah. They're extraordinary people, my dear. But if you look around the world, the people of Yemen are not benefiting from the U.S. drone program. People of Somalia are not benefiting from the U.S. putting warlords on the payroll and utilizing secret prisons buried in Somalia's National Security Service. The Pakistani people are not benefiting from the U.S. drone strikes and the CIA and military dirty tricks. The Afghan people aren't benefiting from the escalated night raids and the periodic bombings that take place in that country. The Iraqi people didn't benefit from the fact that the United States invaded, occupied, destroyed that country, and created a situation where there's a civil war now in that country, and other nations are able to step across the border and get involved with it. The United States shattered Iraq, and now you have calls for the U.S. to intervene in Syria. The U.S. has been intervening in Syria for a very long time, and it's always been against the Syrian people, one way or another. When they use Syria as a source to render and torture Maher Arar, then the dictatorship is acceptable. Then when it starts to become against the perceived U.S. interests, all of a sudden they become a butcher and a dictator. It's a story as old as could be. Just look no further than the history of Iran and Iraq and Saddam Hussein. The United States will support dictators and butchers the world over and say nothing about their butchery until it becomes inconvenient for the empire. And then they'll step in and do it.
Jeremy Scahill, speaking at the conference Socialism 2013 in Chicago, June 2013. One update, a month after this talk, journalist Abdulela Haider Shaya was released from prison in Yemen. He is still forbidden to leave the city of Sana'a, but at least he is no longer behind bars. Thank you for nothing, President Obama. But thank you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. You'll find a free archive of our shows, plus other neat stuff, at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, power to the people, and please come back again next week. Ciao.